This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Jack Sanford was still in high school when the news interrupted an NFL game.
Cuff's still going. He's up to the 25. And now he's hit and hit hard about the 27-yard line. Bruiser Kennard made the tackle.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you this important bulletin from the United Press. Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
It was December 7th, 1941, and the United States was most certainly headed to war. Over the next months and years, many of this country's best athletes would answer the call to join the service. Jack Sanford would have to wait until he was old enough, but we're getting ahead of ourselves. Only a Game's Karen Given has our story.
Haven't gone through this for quite a while. I keep forgetting this is around.
Jack Sanford is flipping through a brown leather scrapbook that holds all the newspaper clippings from his time in baseball. His legal name, John A. Sanford, is inscribed in gold letters on the front.
S-A-N-F-O-R-D. And I said, I was born in Buzzards Bay, right along where the railroad tracks are. I was born right there. And we had a big family. We had five brothers and two girls.
Jack sits in the dining room of the nursing home where he lives in Bourne, Massachusetts. His ex-wife, Carla, brought the scrapbook, and his four-year-old grandson, who might be a little young to appreciate Jack's stories.
I had chances. I mean, I got looked at by the Dodgers and the Braves and the Red Sox. I sent in the dugout with Campanella, Snyder, and Newcomb. I didn't know what to say. You know, I shake the hand going, wow.
Coming out of high school, Jack wanted to sign with the Red Sox. They were always his team. But they didn't have any roster spots available on any of their minor league affiliates, at least not in the U.S.
See, they wanted to send me to the Canadian League, and I said, I'd go, but I said, I've joined the Army. Because they were still drafting, and I figured I was going to get drafted. Well, naturally, after I signed to go in, they stopped the draft. And I'm saying, oh, what did I do?
Someone hands Jack an old black and white photograph. Five young men, two in uniform, stand with one very proud-looking mother.
So this is you and your four brothers?
Yeah.
And you all served in World War II?
Yeah, I went in right at the end.
Mm-hmm.
This one was in Tawara. This was in Bora Bora. And Philip was in the Philippines. Yeah, and this is me here. I couldn't wait to get a uniform on. The minute I graduated from high school, I was in the service. That was it. Next thing I know, I'm in Tokyo. I was saying, what am I doing here? This is wicked.
Jack served as part of the occupying force in Tokyo after the war. He tells a great story about saluting General Douglas MacArthur. He calls him Dugout Doug. Jack and some of the guys formed a baseball team, and one day they squared off against Army's official squad.
Well, I shut them out for about 4 innings, and they come chasing me after the game and saying, we want you to play with it for the Army team. We want you here. I said, I'm going home. Then one of the captains came, and he said, won't you stay for another year? And I said, Cap, I'd love to. But I said, I've been here long enough, and I've been looking forward to going home. You could give me a $100,000 bonus, I said, and I still have to think it over.
Memory is a funny thing. Sometimes when Jack tells this story, he's in Tokyo, and he says he would have stayed if he hadn't been so homesick. Other times, it's at the end of his stint in Korea, and he says he never considered staying because you were lucky if you got out alive. But we're jumping ahead. Jack turned down the folks who wanted him to play baseball for the Army and returned home in February of 1948. At this point in the story, Carla flips to another page in the scrapbook to show me an envelope from the Boston Braves. They'd later become the Atlanta Braves.
Oh, what's that?
That's the original contract that he signed for $150 per month, January 13th, 1949.
Now, is $150 a month enough?
I could have got more. But you were so happy to sign a contract.
Mr. John Sanford, Everett Road, Buzzards Bay, Massachusetts. Dear John, your signed contract has been received by our Boston office. Your name and address have been given to the railroad people in your area. Be looking for a call from the railroad people and be ready to leave your home on the 6th or 7th of April as per the instructions you will receive shortly. Yours truly, Harry C. Jenkins, Farm Director, Boston Braves.
Was I nervous?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I was nervous. It's big leagues, and you're saying, you know, do I belong here?
Among his family, Jack's stories are legendary. His nephew Tom tells me that the family visits and calls as often as they can to listen to him talk, and then they call each other to compare notes. And one of Jack's favorite stories starts one evening at spring training in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, in 1949.
So we went out for a few beers. And the next day, meeting. They knew where we were, how many beers we drank, who left early and who stayed. We got the whole report. They released four of them right in front of me, and they're looking at me. And I'm saying, I'm next. But fortunately, I went home early. I just had a beer or two and I went home. So I didn't get released. And I'm saying, whoa, I gotta behave.
Jack was sent to a Class D team in Bluefield, West Virginia, and then to Class C in Owensboro, Kentucky. But the money wasn't very good, and he decided to go play baseball back home. In the 40s and 50s, the Cape League wasn't a place where very many players got noticed. But no matter, Jack wouldn't be staying for long.
Sagamore, September 28, 1950. Sanford called to Army duty. Upper Cape Star leaves tomorrow.
Oh, I made the biggest mistake I could have ever made.
The year was 1948, and Jack had just returned to the U.S. from overseas. All he had to do was sign for his discharge from the Army. He was brought into a room and shown a pile of papers on a table. He was told, sign or don't sign. It's your choice. Jack signed.
When I got out of the service in 48, a lot of guys said, you didn't sign that paper in the last table. Oh, yeah, I signed it. What the hell did you sign? I said, why? What's wrong? They said, you joined the reserve. I did. I said, you know, I won't get called. Wrong. I did a little swearing then. A month later, I'm in Korea. I'm saying, how the hell did I get here so quick?
Wow, that's one about you. It says, Sagamore pitching, ace Sanford serves in Korea, yearns to pitch.
Yeah, I wrote a letter from Korea. I was, like, kind of homesick.
Just a few lines to shoot the breeze for a few minutes. I'm over here in Busan, Korea now, and with some miracle from heaven, we got shipped down here instead of the front lines. I guess I better not brag, because we may be shipped north any day now. Some guys have a slogan, we'll be back with you in 52. Mine is, let's all be one.
Let's all be one in 51. 51, I was there, and we won the championship.
Jack got back from Korea in time to join the Sagamore Clouders in September of 1951. The Cape Cod Times reported that his team was down 2-0 in the championship series when he came on in relief and won the game. But the newspaper didn't get the whole story that day. See, Jack hadn't actually been released by the Army yet.
What happened was, I left Cam Dix. Now, I hadn't pitched a ball. And I came home and pitched a ball game in the playoffs on the weekend leave and won the game. I went back to New Jersey, waiting to get discharged.
Sagamore's southpaw ace, making his second appearance in the series since being released by the Army, hurled the Clouders to their second straight win over the Lower Cape Champs.
The first time he pitched, Jack was on leave. No big deal. The second time, well, the Army still hadn't released him, and he went AWOL. When he got back to Fort Dix, Jack discovered that there had been some developments while he was away.
How many were there in my outfit? One, me. They were getting discharged, and I was home pitching a ball game. I didn't get in any trouble. Luckily, I think the captain was a baseball fan. I remember him saying to me, did you win? And I said, yeah, he's okay. As long as you won.
The Army finally discharged Jack, but there was still one more game to go in the All-Cape Championship. Jack took the mound for the Clouders and brought them their very first title. The Cape Cod Times noted that he, quote, fanned six, walked one, and held the Cape's most dangerous sluggers to five singles and one two-bagger. Sagamore won another championship in 1954 with Jack Sanford on the mound. But one day in 1955, Jack went to throw the ball and discovered that he couldn't do it.
I didn't hear a clunk, but the ball didn't go very far. The guy that put the pin in Ted Williams' shoulder was in Hyannis, so I went down. He checked me out and he says, "Son, I guess your playing days are over." And I said, oh, come on, Doc. I didn't want to give up, but no. I says, "Jack, that's it. That's got to be it."
Jack says he tried to stay involved with the Cape Cod League for a while, but his wife wanted him home. He had a family and eventually became the campus police chief for the Massachusetts Maritime Academy. In 2005, he was inducted into the Cape Cod Baseball League Hall of Fame.
I didn't pitch to get in any Hall of Fame. I just pitched because I loved the game. I didn't care if they give me a trophy anyway. I got a few of them. My cat broke most of them. He got up on my trophy case one day and walked. I'm going, "Get down." He got down all right with all the trophies. Crash, bang, and I'm going, no.
8 minutes into our conversation, Jack's grandson starts saying that he wants to go home. After 2 hours, I notice that he's camped out under the table we've been sitting at, and the situation is starting to look desperate.
Your grandson has had enough of your stories, I hate to say it.
Oh.
He's done.
I'm sorry. You hiding on me?
We say goodbye and thank Jack for his service. His nephew Tom wheels him back to his room. As we're packing up our equipment, the nursing home staff comes out to set up for lunch. I ask one of the women if she's ever gotten to hear Jack's stories. "Mr. Sanford?" she asks. "Nah, he's usually pretty quiet."
That's Only a Game's Karen Given. She had help from former intern Sean Gannon. Jack Sanford died in March of 2016, just 3 months after our story first aired. In lieu of flowers, his family asked that donations be made in his name to the Cape Cod Baseball League. When Red Hill Sr. returned from World War I, doctors told him he had just 6 months to live. A few days later, he was called to a boat stranded on the river.
When he got there, soldiers from both sides of the border, firemen, police were there, but nobody knew what to do because the scow was about 1,200 feet offshore. And the only man who had the expertise was Red Hill.
How Red Hill Sr. saved 28 people from drowning on the Niagara, one or two at a time. Just ahead on Only a Game from NPR. It's come to my attention that last week I thanked C. Ross 67 for an Apple Podcast review left by Stonefield 75. Silly me. My apologies, Stonefield 75, and thanks for your review. This week, I really would like to send out thanks to C. Ross 67 for the following review on Apple Podcasts. It's not about sports, it's about history, sociology, human behavior, and more, seen through the window of sports. Always informative, interesting, and fun. Go, Only a Game team. Our thanks to everyone who's left a review of Only a Game on Apple Podcasts. Whether I say your username on the air or not, your thoughts really do help other listeners to find our show. I'm Bill Littlefield, and it's time for three stories you should know.
Our country's an embarrassment in the world. I wonder what the people think about who voted for him. Where their line is, how much they can take.
That is Spurs coach Greg Popovich, who has been a frequent critic of President Donald Trump, and that's where we're going to start this week. My guests are The Wall Street Journal's Rachel Bachman and The Atlantic's Eric Malinowski via Skype. Welcome back, Rachel.
Great to be here.
And Eric, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
Eric, why don't you start us off?
All right. So, yes, Greg Popovich, he's been quite the vocal critic of this current administration for going on a year plus now. And so this has got me thinking a little bit about Greg Popovich and sort of the end game with all of this, because he has been pretty vocal about this. This is a guy who, you know, called up Dave Zirin of The Nation unsolicited, you know, just to tell him that Trump is a pathological liar, and then hung up, you know, gave all these quotes and then, you know, said goodbye and had his say. So this is a very purposeful campaign by Greg Popovich. And you've seen this in other corners of the NBA with his protege Steve Kerr of the Warriors and LeBron James and some of the other players in this league. But it's interesting because Trump has not dignified Popovich's comments in any way. And so I feel like, you know, with the recent election here, I feel like progressives and liberals probably feel very empowered with the direction that the country is headed. You know, I think the Trump administration, their grasp seems pretty tenuous as time goes on. And so I feel like we're only going to see escalation in the intensity of all of this. And so I'm just curious, if we game this out, what does this look like over the next 6 months, perhaps a year? What do we think the next year is going to look like in terms of the war of words between Popovich and this current administration?
Rachel, you want to take on a little Nostradamus for us?
Well, one intriguing question is whether Popovich would ever consider running for office. He would be a fascinating candidate, you know, a graduate of the Air Force Academy. He climbed the rank of major, I believe. He served in the reserves after he finished. He's won 5 NBA titles with the Spurs. They're in contention again this year. And he's also in a deeply red state, which certainly makes his comments even more interesting. But it's also a state that has become a little more tumultuous given the recent political climate. So that would be a very intriguing candidacy, whatever he chose to run for, if he ever did.
Yeah, he's also working for an owner and an owner's wife who have contributed about $500,000 to Donald Trump's fundraising committee. So, there's a certain amount of courage involved in speaking out this way. I have to admit, Eric, I was hoping that what you were going to do with this topic was break the story that Pop for President was, in fact, in motion and that fundraising had begun and the bumper stickers would be in the mail shortly. But I gather you're not quite ready to do that yet.
Well, I do drink my coffee most mornings out of a mug that says Popovich Kerr 2020. So I'm just going to keep hope alive, and we'll just see what time brings us.
For our listeners who perhaps have not been entirely current with the news, Steve Kerr, coach of the Warriors, is the other coach who has spoken up quite a bit along very much the same lines as Coach Popovich. Rachel, your turn.
Well, speaking of the military, the U.S. Army is proposing a radical overhaul of the physical fitness test that all soldiers have to pass every year. The current test has been in place since 1980, when people thought that combat was basically obsolete. We'd all have nothing but nuclear battles. So we're moving from potentially sit-ups, push-ups, and a 2-mile run to a 6-event test that includes multiple weightlifting events, including a run with 40-pound kettlebells and a deadlift of well over 100 pounds. So this would be a significant change in and of itself, but another change is even more radical, and I stress these are just proposals, but they're getting close on this, and that would be to eliminate gender-based standards, meaning that there would be one uniform set of standards that all soldiers would have to pass, no exceptions for gender or age. This would be the first Army-wide test that did not make exceptions for gender. And this is really reflecting an Army that now has opened all jobs to women, including combat roles. And I'm curious what you gentlemen think of this radical shift toward a much more physical test and potentially equality of the sexes.
Okay, Eric, I'm going to invite you to put one or both feet into your mouth first.
I'll touch all 3 rails at the same time. First of all, I think it was a pretty shocking admission that the current testing is only about 40% predictive of a current soldier's ability to perform the tasks that are required of them. And I guess it's really great that this new testing standards would essentially double that to 80%. I think that it's all pretty positive, and it sounds like they're heading on the right track.
I hope that the best of this does, in fact, come to pass, that people are happy with the new tests and the new exercises, and it sounds like people may even get healthier trying to do these things. And I hope it stays at that level and that we don't see a lot of people heading into combat to test these skills. I feel a little bit like I do when somebody says to me, how do you feel about women boxing? And I say, I'm against it. And they say, well, then you're a sexist. And I say, no, I'm not. I'm against men boxing as well. I don't see why anybody should get their brains scrambled for money, and we should provide them all with better ways to make a living. But I'll let you wrap that up, Rachel, and tell me that I'm full of beans.
No, I think there definitely are some concerns about this. I spoke with one man, actually, who was concerned that women could be discriminated against if they couldn't perform well enough to test into certain jobs and so on. So that's definitely a risk.
Okay, it's my turn, and I want to talk a little about Jerry Jones, the owner of the Dallas Cowboys. He is making noises about suing the National Football League if Commissioner Roger Goodell is offered a contract extension by the NFL's Compensation Committee after the 2018 season. An unnamed team executive, surprising that this guy doesn't want to go on the record, has been quoted as saying that a lot of owners are not happy with Roger Goodell, but it's only Jerry Jones who's talking about suing the league if they plan to continue to employ him. I'm going to give you guys the opportunity to don your judicial robes and tell me whether you think this is a frivolous lawsuit or whether you think this lawsuit has merit. Rachel, you first.
Well, I'm going to defend Roger Goodell here, believe it or not, and that is because I think that the challenges he's facing, whoever's sitting in his seat would have to face, and they're not easy. The anthem protests are very divisive. They're just a difficult issue to handle, given the strong feelings on both sides. Certainly, Jerry Jones was very upset about the handling of one of his players, Ezekiel Elliott, and he claimed that Roger Goodell overreacted in punishing him for an alleged domestic assault. And he might have, but he was responding to a previous impression by the public that the NFL was not tough enough on domestic abusers. So, you know, whoever's in that chair is going to have to make some incredibly tough decisions, and some of them are going to be dead wrong. And I don't think that necessarily changing him is going to make them easier to resolve.
Eric, Rachel seems to be suggesting that Mr. Jones may be responding to a personal insult. didn't want his player penalized as seriously as the commissioner penalized him. Does this make sense to you?
Yeah, I can't imagine why somebody would think that. I'm completely in Rachel's corner here. I'm going to also defend Roger Goodell. As smug as I find his attitude sometimes and his comments odious on various matters, I don't think that you could argue against the idea that he has done a remarkable job, I think, of insulating these owners against any number of scandals and controversies largely over the years. The NFL is still very much basically printing money. So Roger Goodell has written out so many other past scandals. I think that he probably has the odds in his favor on this one. But I don't know, a determined Jerry Jones feels like a force that maybe you don't want to quite go up against.
Yeah, I'm sure that he is a force to be reckoned with. And it does give us something to watch going forward as the NFL season proceeds. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been The Wall Street Journal's Rachel Bachman and The Atlantic's Eric Malinowski. Thanks, Eric, very much for joining us again.
Thanks, Bill.
And Rachel, thanks to you. A pleasure as always for us.
Thanks so much.
Red Hill Sr. suffered terrible injuries fighting in France with the Canadian Army's 4th Division during World War I, but perhaps his most dangerous foe was a river and its famous falls back home. Only a Game's Gary Wallach has the story.
William Red Hill Sr. was born on October 27, 1887, in Niagara Falls, Ontario. His career saving lives began when he carried his 4-year-old sister, Cora, out of their family's burning home. For his bravery, he was awarded a medal from the Royal Canadian Humane Society. He was just 9 years old. But the perilous waters of the Niagara River, not fire, was where he saved the most lives. Hill became a powerful swimmer. As a young man, he swam the Niagara's lower rapids from the American to the Canadian side in a record time of 11 minutes. In 1911, Hill rescued Bobby Leach, a stuntman from England who tried to go over the falls in a vessel Clarkson calls a glorified septic tank. The following year, Hill made international headlines.
In 1912, it was allowed for tourists to go below the falls on these big formed ice bridges. In fact, Red Hill Sr. had a whiskey hut. He would sell whiskey and other liquor on the ice bridge below, right below the falls. But one day, ice cracked and the floes parted and the tourists were separated and screaming and running for help. Red Hill Sr. was able to get 23 of them off to shore. Unfortunately, a man and his wife were trapped and died in an ice floe which went down the rapids and into the whirlpool.
Hill fought in France during World War I with the Canadian Army's 4th Division, which helped the Allies capture Vimy Ridge from the Germans. He suffered poison gas inhalation, tuberculosis, and a gunshot wound during his tour of duty. He was given 6 months to live by a doctor and was sent home to die. But a couple days later...
I think one of the incredible rescues of all time in North America was when Red Hill plucked two men off a scow above Niagara Falls in 1918.
A small dredging scow with two men aboard broke free of its tugboat and grounded on rocks 1,500 yards above the falls.
When he got there, soldiers from both sides of the border, firemen, police were there, but nobody knew what to do because the scow was about 1,200 feet offshore. And the only man who had the expertise was Red Hill. So he went out and crawled along these lines which were shot out to the scow from a building on shore. It took him many hours, but he was able to scramble and rescue these two men, these two sailors, off the scow one at a time and received a life-saving medal for that.
But as Red Hill Sr. made headlines for his daring rescues, the river brought out the daredevil in him. In 1920, Hill jumped in Bobby Leach's barrel, yes, the same glorified septic tank, and rode it about 10 miles through the perilous Lower Rapids to Queenstown, Ontario. He repeated that journey in 1930, and again in 1931, before about 25,000 spectators.
He got trapped in the whirlpool, and his teenage son, Red Hill Jr., became the newest hero, and he swam out with a rope around his waist and saved his father from the whirlpool. After that, Red Sr. Did not try any more daredevil feats. Red Hill Sr. died in 1942 of natural causes. He was only 54 years old, but his wife Beatrice thought the river in World War I wore his body down.
During his lifetime, Red Hill Sr. recovered the bodies of 177 people who died from accident or suicide. He's officially credited with saving the lives of 28 people from drowning. He received more life-saving awards from the Canadian government than any person in history.
Red Hill Sr., I think he was a true hero. The Red Hill family, I think, was the first family of Niagara Falls.
Red Hill Sr. had planned several times to go over the falls, but he never attempted it. He called it a fool's game. His sons Corky and Wesley limited themselves to rescue and recovery missions. Another son, Major Hill, tried going over once but ran aground before he reached the falls. And 9 years after his father's death, Red Hill Jr. started planning.
People still wonder and ask questions about why Red Hill Jr. went over the falls. After researching it for 40 years, I can't put one answer to it. In Red Hill Jr.'s case, his life was a bit of a mess at the time in 1951. He'd just become separated from his wife and daughter. His father had died 9 years prior to that. He really missed him. He had been charged as a game warden with misappropriating funds and spent a little time in jail. The family's reputation was sullied a little bit. I think Junior wanted to bring that back.
But Clarkson thinks Junior rushed through the planning.
He thought he knew the river better than anyone and put together a barrel of 13 inner tubes lashed with fishnet. And he was warned by his friends and other rivermen that he, at 150 pounds, weighed more than the barrel, and that he would be thrown out of the barrel if it got into trouble in the upper rapids.
Red Jr.'s one and only attempt came on August 4th, 1951.
There was a tremendous crowd at the brink of the falls. There had been a lot of publicity over this. Newspapers estimated the crowd anywhere from 100,000 to 300,000 people. So it was a really big event. He got into the river probably a mile above the falls at Chippewa, and slowly went down the river with all these people watching, cheering, and then finally aghast at the barrel coming apart. And I think he was probably dead before he went over the falls.
The grieving Hill family mostly stayed away from the river after that. Their mother and Red Hill Sr.'s widow, Beatrice, passed away in 1974 after a life of heartbreak. She simply couldn't understand why she had been unable to keep her men away from the river and why it held such a lure for them. After talking with many other people fascinated by the river, Clarkson has a theory.
I think the Niagara seems to draw people, seems to pull them. William Fitzgerald, who went over in 1961 in a rubber ball, he told me that when he was 5 years old, he went to Niagara Falls with his parents, and that roar of Niagara Falls stayed with him, haunting him for years. That damn water wouldn't shut up. The raw power, he said, that unleashed power.
The hills never shut out that roar, and their story didn't end in 1951 with Red Jr.'s death, because the hills inspired daredevils who still admire them and remember their stories.
As a teenager in the 1950s, Dave Munday, the stories of the hills really enraptured him. He knew the hills never got over the falls and lived. And in 1985, yes, he did it. And he survived. The Red Hill family, I think they made it over the falls in a way because they inspired Dave Munday.
Peter DiBernardi, who went over the falls in 1989, started a campaign in 2016 to raise money for a memorial at Niagara Falls.
To date, there is no memorial for the Red Hill family. Red Hill and his sons did not get the credit they deserved for everything they did on the river. The rescues, the daredevil acts, bringing attention to Niagara Falls. And yes, there needs to be some sort of memorial for the Red Hill family.
That's Michael Clarkson speaking with Only a Game's Gary Wallach. That story first aired in January of 2017. You can learn more about the Red Hill family in Clarkson's book, The Age of Daredevils. Ahead on Only a Game, a tale of two veterans who met on the Rose Bowl gridiron on the battlefield in Italy and then again after the war.
Charles Haynes embraced Frank Parker, gave him a hug, told everyone at the reunion, kept pointing out that this was the man who saved his life.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Hi, I'm Erica Lance, and I think you might like this podcast I produce, also from WBUR, called Kind World. Kind World tells deeply personal stories about the pivotal moments in our lives.
She called me one day and she says, "Why are you choosing to live in our grief?" And I said, "I'm not. I'm choosing to live in your love."
All of those women were witness to the darkest and probably most intimate moment of my life, and they gave me a sliver of light.
I talked to all kinds of people about times when they felt alone or scared or overwhelmed and how they got through it with the help of others.
I even thought I was a little crazy, but then I'm like, wait, I could do anything I want. I could raise $1 million if I want to. I could cure this disease.
I think that he bypassed all that and just said, "I see a human being who needs my help, and I'm going to help him."
Head over to WBUR.org/kindworld or just subscribe in your favorite podcast app.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up next week on Only a Game, from a man who stood shoulder to shoulder with G.I. Joe as the Care Bears frolicked nearby, a collection of 250 sports miracles, including one of his own. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
A new federal indictment against Adidas executive Jim Gatto claims that former Louisville head coach Rick Pitino was less than entirely candid when he said he knew nothing about a scheme to pay recruit Brian Bowen to play basketball at Louisville. The FBI says it has recordings that suggest otherwise. Are you stunned enough to require smelling salts?
I'm still trying to get over the fact that the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the federal court system are now involved in enforcing NCAA regulations. This is an absurd waste of taxpayers' money and absurd abuse of prosecutorial power. Am I surprised at the story qua story? Not at all. No.
John Wooden winner of 10 national titles as the head basketball coach at UCLA, died in 2010. Charlie, it's been 42 years since he last coached a basketball team. This week, former Indiana head coach Bob Knight said, "I've never been a Wooden fan." Why is Knight taking on John Wooden now?
Because it's about time somebody did. John Wooden's success depended somewhat vitally on a booster named Sam Gilbert, who was a real sleazy character. You may think Bob Knight indiscreet and uncivil for bringing up now, but it should come up every time John Wooden's legacy is discussed. Once upon a time, I was talking with the great basketball funny person and coach Abe Lemons, and he went on the pregame show one time. There was a doubleheader, and his team was playing in the first game, and then UCLA was playing in the second game. And he went on the pregame show of the UCLA radio network and was asked by the guy what he thought of John Wooden's famous pyramid of success. And Abe said, "Well, I could build me a pyramid for success if I had Sam Gilbert supplying the concrete." And as Abe said later, "I was not invited back on that show."
I hope it was live.
It was.
Last week, LeBron James dropped 57 points on the Washington Wizards and became the youngest player in NBA history to reach the 29,000 mark for career points. Young is a relative term. LeBron James is in his 15th season in the league, and he's 32. You think he'll endure long enough to catch Kareem at 38,387?
He's going to have a few more of those 57-point games. Mm. But, yeah, I mean, it is remarkable that he's still only 32 years old. I mean, it seems like he's been playing.
It seems like he played
with George Mikan.
He's been there forever. Charlie, Roy Halladay was a very successful major league pitcher from 1998 until 2013 when he retired, won over 200 games. On Tuesday, he was killed when the small plane he was piloting crashed into the Gulf of Mexico. Memories of Roy Halladay?
Yeah, one of the best times I ever had watching a game on television was with some friends in a restaurant in New York watching him pitch his no-hitter in the World Series. He was very much a throwback. He would pitch as often as you wanted him to. He had what they used to call a rubber arm, and this is just tragic and awful.
Charlie, I learned this week that it is possible for a football team to score too many points. The Philadelphia Eagles did it on Sunday at the expense of the Denver Broncos. And how do we know that Philadelphia did, in fact, score too many points?
Because they ran out of fireworks, Bill. You know, you shoot off this thing every time the Eagles score, and then, you know, they got to 59, and somebody looked in the ammunition locker, and there wasn't anything left.
The fireworks box was empty. The Cleveland Browns, 0-8 going into the weekend, 0-8. I don't even know what the right question is for this. Help.
Well, it's the second year in a row they've been 0-8, so they're accustomed to this. You know, they're used to playing with this kind of lack of pressure. I mean, certainly the playoff pressure's off. Their exhibits A through L for the plaintiff in Colin Kaepernick's collusion suit against the NFL. They've tried everybody in Cleveland except Dennis Kucinich at quarterback.
Well, and it's not just Cleveland. This week, the Houston Texans signed a quarterback who has not thrown a forward pass since 2011. And I read that and I thought, what a shame that there's not a quarterback available who threw a pass as recently as last year.
Yeah, but to be fair, Josh Johnson was with the team in 2013. He didn't do anything, but he was with the team. Yeah, this is getting more ridiculous by the day.
It is time for our almost weekly Yamir Yager watch update. On Thursday, the 45-year-old Calgary Flame forward tallied his first goal of the season. So now the goals will come in bunches, right?
Yeah, I hope so. I just love I love this story. He got his first goal for his ninth team. Hmm. He can't play for all the teams. It's really too bad.
No,
it's although
in, you know, the old days when it was
in the
only
old days
six,
he could have done it.
He could have easily
done it.
Done it. Right.
Could have done it twice.
Finally, Charlie, Andy Murray and Roger Federer met for an exhibition match in Scotland, and it says here it was a very competitive match, but as Federer wore a kilt for some of it and Murray wore a Scottish bonnet, I'm guessing that was not entirely true.
I think this is great and good on Federer. I mean, it's one thing to wear a bonnet, but it's another thing to go out there in a kilt.
I agree. You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time. And, of course, he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
The first thing Charles Haynes and Frank Parker had in common was that they played in the same football game. For a couple of reasons, it was an unusual game. It was canceled, argued about, then uncanceled, and then relocated. The game customarily took place on New Year's Day in Pasadena, California, but not in January of 1942. That was because on December 7, 1941, the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor. Pasadena was close enough to Hawaii to arouse concern.
And about 6 days after Pearl Harbor, Lieutenant General John DeWitt, who was in charge of the 4th Army on the West Coast based on the Presidio in San Francisco, made the determination that the Rose Bowl game should not be played, that if that many people were in the same spot, the Japanese bombers were likely to target it and the Rose Parade. So he asked the governor of California to call off the game, which he did.
That's Brian Curtis, who has studied and written about the events of that time, among them the debate over the fate of the 1942 Rose Bowl game.
Many in America were split, and the newspapers nationally weighed in. There were editorials stating that we are now a country of war. Our young boys are going off to fight. The last thing we should be thinking of is playing some silly football game. Then there were other newspapers and Americans that weighed in and said, wait a minute, if we stop playing our games, if we stop living our lives, then the Japanese have beat us, even though they only attacked us in Pearl Harbor and Hawaii.
The latter point of view won out. The 1942 Rose Bowl game was played, but it was relocated to Durham, North Carolina, home of Duke University. Oregon State would play Duke because, as the winners of the Pacific Coast Conference, Oregon State had earned the right to pick their opponent. They chose Duke, the team generally regarded to be the nation's strongest that season. Oregon State graciously agreed to travel across the country for the game. Duke's roster included Charles Haynes, a local boy from Durham.
Charles was a good student, a great wrestler, an okay football player, a Boy Scout, an Eagle Scout, whose father worked for the American Tobacco Company in Durham, as tobacco at that point was still the center of life in Durham and much of North Carolina. He matriculated to Duke and played on the football team for Coach Wallace Wade, often found himself more as a cheerleader from the sidelines as opposed to playing.
Among those determined to upset Haynes and his highly regarded teammates was Frank Parker, an imposing Oregon State guard.
Frank Parker couldn't have been farther away, literally and figuratively, from Charles Haynes. Parker was a very poor boy whose father died running bootleg liquor on Christmas Day when he was just 12 years old. At the age of 13 or 14, was helping to pick up trash and drive dump trucks with his stepfather, who actually was his uncle, but that's another long story, and was smart enough and good enough and strong enough to go to Oregon State University and start studying agriculture.
Charles Haynes, the son of a wealthy tobacco merchant, may or may not have had any contact with Frank Parker, son of a dead bootlegger, before, during, or after that transplanted football game in which Oregon State upset Duke before an estimated 50,000 spectators. Shortly thereafter, Haynes and Parker had something else in common. They were both in the Army. Haynes was turned down the first time he tried to enlist. He had to memorize the eye chart to pass the physical. Parker also enlisted, and during what must have seemed an interminable delay, he was shipped from base to base within the U.S. By the early summer of 1944, Haynes was in Italy, fighting for territory, hill by hill, yard by yard. And that's where he crossed paths once again with his former Rose Bowl opponent.
In July of 1944, Frank Parker finally came over to Italy as a replacement soldier. And within a day or two of his arrival, they met. Frank was very shy and quiet, contrary to his large behemoth size. Charles Haynes was always willing to strike up a conversation, and he did with Parker. And very quickly, they realized their connection, that they had both played in this remarkably transplanted Rose Bowl game, you know, at that point, 2.5 years earlier. So they became friendly. They were stationed, obviously, in the same division, almost in the same platoon. So they often were fighting side by side in action.
On a day when the two former rivals were not side by side, Charles Haynes led his company up a hill he'd thought was quiet. He was surprised by a German artillery attack.
So he was wounded, had wounds in his chest the size of a fist, wounds in his leg. It started to rain. It was too dangerous for his fellow soldiers to rescue him. So for 17 hours, Haynes thought he was dying, coming in and out of consciousness. Word had gotten back to Frank Parker, who was in another part of the fight, that Haynes had been wounded, And it was Parker and another soldier that made their way up to the top of this ridge. Haynes was conscious at the time. He recognized Parker. Parker and this other soldier were able to carry Haynes under fire down a hill to a medical aid station.
Parker returned to battle immediately after the rescue. Haynes spent several months in hospital and then returned to his unit. When the war ended, Haynes took up the life of a wealthy young man in Durham once again. He ran a construction business, he opened up a restaurant, he was apparently able to leave behind the horrors of battle. The man who saved his life was not so fortunate.
Frank Parker suffered like many veterans did. In fact, he stayed over in Europe an extra year or so when he didn't have to, because he was so worried that he had changed fundamentally as a person, as a human, as a Christian, that he was not the same person that his wife, Peggy, had married.
Haynes, gregarious after the war as well as before it, thrived in business and in his personal life. He told people about Frank Parker and the exceptional coincidence that had found his former opponent on the football field saving his life on a muddy hill in Italy. Parker eventually returned to Oregon. He rarely told his family anything about what he'd seen and done during the war, and he found adjustment to civilian life as hard as he'd feared it might be.
I think even his children understood at an early age that Dad had issues and at times would disappear into a bar for a day or two. Never heard his kids, never heard his family, you know, got into fishing and would disappear for months on end.
Parker apparently felt that absence would spare his family embarrassment and shame.
And it really wasn't until he was about to attempt suicide after his wife's passing, well into his 70s, that he finally went to a VA and was hospitalized for a couple months.
During the years after the war, Haynes and Parker rode each other a few times. Duke hosted a reunion for both teams from the 42 Rose Bowl, but Frank Parker didn't make the trip from Oregon. So Haynes, restaurateur and businessman, and Parker, disappointed fisherman, didn't see each other until October 1991, when Oregon State hosted a 50th reunion gathering for the veterans of the only Rose Bowl game ever to have transpired outside of Pasadena. Haynes was determined to get to that second grand occasion.
Charles Haynes made the effort to cross the country solely to be able to see Frank Parker and thank him. Charles Haynes embraced Frank Parker, gave him a hug, told everyone at the reunion, kept pointing out that this was the man who saved his life. As they read the names of deceased players for Oregon State and Duke, Haynes started to cry and looked across the room at Parker.
Parker presented Haynes with a money clip carved from a whale's tooth, a souvenir of the months Parker had spent at sea as a fisherman. Haynes was the beneficiary of Parker's exceptional courage, and Parker was a hero. Hero is a word too often applied to football players and other athletes who save nobody. But though Frank Parker saved Charles Haynes, he couldn't rescue himself from the consequences of the terrible personal damage he suffered during the war. The unraveling of Parker's life after the war is something Brian Curtis feels shouldn't be forgotten.
We think of this generation as the greatest generation for their heroism, which is absolutely true. What we don't hear a lot about is the homelessness, the divorce, the alcohol, the lack of mental health care that many of these gentlemen got. So Frank Parker suffered like many veterans did, never fully came to grips of the man he became.
Charles Haynes suffered a heart attack and died in 1994, just 3 years after the reunion in Oregon. Frank Parker was eventually diagnosed with PTSD and depression. He died in a nursing home in 2002. Our story on Charles Haynes and Frank Parker originally aired in December of last year. In his book, Fields of Battle, Pearl Harbor, the Rose Bowl, and the Boys Who Went to War, Brian Curtis explores at greater length the lives of Haynes, Parker, and some of the other young men who went directly from the football field to the war in Europe. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our intern is Brian Bouchard. And our senior producer is Karen Given. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more Sports NPR Style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.